listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
The amount of information we have on how our brains actually work has grown exponentially in the last 20 years. It helps us know how we work, what kinds of changes may be possible for us, and it can also help us with our most intimate and important relationships. My guest today has brought together brain science, as well as what we know about early life attachment and emotional regulation, so that we can understand how to create deep, lasting, loving, and satisfying relationships. I invite you to join us in our discussion. You can talk to Dr. Tatkin and me on either of our chats at emotionalpro.com and at blogtalkradio.com/FPR. We also have a toll-free number, 888-498-0570, 888-498-0570. And I know you're going to want to talk with Dr. Tatkin because we're talking about your brain on love and love and war in relationships. And all so many of us are trying to do long-term relationships. Stan Tatkin has a PsyD, and he's a marriage and family therapist. He's a clinician, a researcher, a teacher, and a developer of a psychobiological approach to couple therapy, which he calls PACT. He has a clinical practice in Calabasas, California. He developed the PACT Institute for the purpose of training other psychotherapists to use the method he's developed in their clinical practice, PACT. In addition, Dr. Tatkin teaches and supervises family medicine residents at Kaiser Permanente in Woodland Hills, California. He's an assistant clinical professor at the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine in the Department of Family Medicine, and he's on the board of directors of Lifespan Learning Institute. He also serves as a member on Relationships First Council, which is a nonprofit organization founded by the fantastic Harville Hendricks and his wonderful wife, Helen McKelly Hunt. Dr. Stan Tatkin, welcome to Full Power Living.
Hi, that was a mouthful.
Well, you know, that's the problem with living a few years. After a while, you've got a lot of stuff. So, you're likely aware that I've been a psychotherapist for 42 years, and I received training in family systems therapy, and I've seen lots and lots of couples, and I certainly recognize that your approach to working with couples is very different from what I learned about, what I've heard about even in recent years. So we're going to talk today about what has changed your focus, and a lot of it has to do with your knowledge of attachment theory and also about what happens in the brain. And I think you said that you got into this work because you used to work with attachment theory with infants. Is that correct?
That's correct. Actually, my expertise back in the day was working with what's called personality disorders or disorders of the self. And that led me to work in prevention with mother-infant pairs. I wanted to see if I could work and intervene early. I was really impressed with programs that were doing that. And then that sort of morphed into studying adult pair bonding. For a long stint there, I started learning a great deal about neuroscience and the nervous system, and so gradually developed this psychobiological approach.
And on the level of brain, this was something that surprised me because I hadn't really thought of it. You say that we're wired for being in a dyad because of how we start off as children.
Well, how we started off as children, also how we started off, we believe, in terms of social animals. You know, we became social animals, at least dyadically, to protect each other from predators and from the environment. And we would have an offspring, and be together for at least 4 years to protect the offspring. And that began to spread out into larger groups and communities and eventually civilizations. But even now, we start off as a dyad. I'd say we start off as a single cell organism, but we, you know, eventually become a dyad. And even though we do develop into groups and communities larger than twos, we're still, I think, inherently dyadic. And there's a lot of evidence for this in the way that people get into a trance through each other's eyes and the whole falling in love syndrome. You fall in love with a person. It's hard to fall in love with a group. I guess you could, but generally it's with a person.
Mm-hmm. And so you end up, now I've been very interested in codependence myself, and so I was really interested in your saying that we essentially are addicted to being in relationship, and that in order to make a long-term relationship work well, we need essentially to feed that addiction. If I've understood you right, could you explain that a little bit?
Well, there's two things you said. One, codependency was something, back in the days of co-alcoholic came out of the AA tradition. Co-alcoholic, the person who was involved with the alcoholic, and that later changed into codependence, and basically means that that codependent person is involved in a one-way deal, that they put everything into the relationship but do not get an equal amount back, and they're angry about that, but they continue to do this. And so that's what we think of as the codependent. It's an unfair deal. But the addiction part really is the infatuation. There's several aspects of love. One is the what's called the dopaminergic system, the dopamine system. And it's a reward system that the infatuation, the initial feelings of being in love, the exciting love, hits that system. And that makes us want to come back for more. The kind of love that exists, I think, in the long run is varied, and it's not dependent on that reward circuit. It's dependent on other systems that are relaxing and bonding, and where, people feel safe. But that idea of the exciting love and being able to stoke the fires is still important in long-term relationships. It must be there, I think, in order to keep excitement and novelty going. And there are ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. So I liked what you were saying. I think I was listening to your album called Your Brain on Love, and you said various things like, it's not easy being connected to another person. And you also alluded to the fact that the best connection with another person is one in which we help each other, or we connect with each other by understanding how the other person attaches.
Right.
That's correct?
This idea, yeah. Well, we think of it as having your partner's owner's manual. Oftentimes people will say that they're really good at work. I'm really good at what I do. I'm good at my profession. And then one might ask that same person, are you good at her? Or are you good at him? And often the answer will be no. In terms of love and work complexity, love seems to be the more complex of the two. Requires more resources, more capacities. And so, we're talking here about interdependency also, not, dependency or autonomy, but interdependency, two nervous systems depending on each other for nervous system regulation. In other words, how do these two people, how skillful, how good are they at calming each other down, diminishing distress, and creating excitement? That really is, I think, about two people doing it well together. And in order to do that, you have to know who you are, where you come from, why you are the way you are, and accept yourself. But you also have to know your partner, to be an expert. I know exactly everything about you, how you work, what to do when you're sad, what to do when you're in pain, what to do when you're excited. I'm good at you. And I think that's the spirit of what we're talking about.
Oh, wow. How many people hit that mark?
a surprising large number of people, actually. It depends on who you hang around with. But really what we're talking about is two people caring enough to pay attention and to attend to one another the way that our parents, you know, hopefully attended to us or should have attended to us, paying attention and also creating a system that's truly mutual, good for me, good for you, based on, you know, a system that is fair and just and sensitive. That actually is extremely doable. We see people who are homeless street people forming secure functioning relationships with each other, and they're not mentally well. If they can do it, certainly the average person can do it. We see people in the military doing this. We see people in police cars, you know, the partners or police car partners, they can do it. And I think it's generally because somewhere either the system demands it and expects that kind of solidarity and commitment, or the environment demands it, where two people have to be in a foxhole together and they learn to take care of each other in the secure functioning way that we're talking about.
While I appreciate that, my own early childhood attachment, I'm sure, was screwed up. There was nobody around to tell me everything that happened, but I know I was left by my birth mother at age 6 months when I had whooping cough, left with a babysitter ostensibly for a couple of hours, and she didn't return for 3 days.
Okay,
I could go on. There are many various ways, and I eventually was removed from her at age less than three. What about if you didn't get a good attachment? You know, I feel like I have been able to heal a lot of things, but the way you describe it, it's like things happen so quickly in the brain, early experiences may override whatever fixing you're doing. Can you talk about that for a minute?
The attachment system, let's just explain to the audience about attachment. Here we're talking about a subjective experience of feeling safe and secure with one's primary dependency relationships. And so, and the reason that security must be there is so that resources can be devoted to developing the self and also to do life without having to be anxious all the time. So there is no screwed up attachment. There's only a system of attachment, a culture. And we all come from a certain family culture. We adapt to that culture. So when we look at attachment styles, as problematic as they may be to another person, they're simply forms of adaptation. It's natural. It's normal. It's biological. But it does run us into trouble in adulthood. And when we want to have a long-term relationship, we may be behaving or expecting things in a way that's not compatible with true mutuality. But that's a huge part of the population. It's not a problem. It's a matter, I think, of understanding the principles of you know, being in the foxhole together or a couple bubble, or basically, you know, two people deciding to create an ecosystem where they're protecting each other from the environment and from each other based on principles, rules of engagement. And that is something that everybody can do. It doesn't matter where you're at, what your background is. I mean, everybody has suffered some injury, loss, trauma from their childhood. I don't think anybody gets through completely unscathed. So and the kind of thing you're talking about where the brain would change, that would take an extraordinary amount of neglect or abuse for that to happen. Other than that, we just adapt.
Oh, wonderful.
And we're healed by every good relationship we have subsequently. Otherwise, attachment would be a done deal. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Now, you operate some this way, and I know that Dr. Harville Hendricks offers the notion, when we go to select a partner, we look, we are attracted to what he calls the best and the worst of what we have known as children. So we're attracted,
yes.
And you say we're attracted to what we know.
Brain, in terms of pair bonding, getting together with somebody who we're going to spend more than a few days with, the pair bonding brain only selects by way of familiarity. We select people based on recognition, and some of that is familial. And so there is actually a part of our brain that's making choices based on memory. This is neither a good nor bad aspect. It doesn't have a good or badness to it. It's simply the brain likes familiar when it comes to pair bonding. It likes novelty when everything else. But in terms of relationship, romance, we go to the person that we recognize, and this can be proven, actually, how similar people really are that get together. They're really strikingly similar, despite appearances of being opposite.
You say that we're hardwired for short-term relationships. And as you mentioned earlier when you were talking, the fact that we want to go longer in relationships may have some societal basis. We are not quite sure why we want to do that, but it requires a lot more work because nature itself just cares whether we find somebody, mate, and continue the species.
Well, that refers to actually the you know, that humans are not naturally, I was going to say monogamous, but that's not actually accurate. But sticking with one person, and we're not. However, as we get older, I think we do become more that way, and that's a biochemical thing for many. For some, it's not. I think that we, despite the fact that we're living longer and our lives are far more complex than they were when we were, cave dwelling, I think the main reason that we want to be in long-term relationships is for the same reason I mentioned before, that the safety and security that two people can create, the cover they can create for each other, the resources they can free up for one another, the resources they can actually create for one another, is a reason to stay together and reason people do stay together successfully. They understand that they do better together than they would do alone, despite the fact that, like everybody else, they find each other annoying and irritating a lot. They are absolutely committed to being safe with each other, and they provide absolute unequivocal security to one another. This comes from an adult understanding of what it's like to be in the foxhole together, that that two people can do things to create a sense of safety that one can't do by oneself. It's just not going to be possible. So I think that the culture needs to shift in order to hold that idea. We have too many prevailing notions of why be coupled in our culture and in our world, and it's very confusing, and none of them seem to be very thoughtful in terms of how to sustain, why to sustain a relationship through a long period. And that's really the question, mm-hmm. I think your audience should really ask themselves. What is the point of being coupled? What if you are in a couple, what do you guys serve? What do you do for each other that you couldn't pay somebody else to do? What's so special about you? And it has to be beyond the usual answers that people give. There has to be some substance to their argument. They actually serve one another.
Mm-hmm.
They understand it. They get it.
That's really good. I remember being given a spiritual definition of marriage once that I liked, which is when one whole complete unit and another whole complete unit come together and form something more, which is called a unity.
Yes.
And yes.
Dan Siegel calls this the mui. It's a me and plus we, the mui.
The mui. Oh, that's nice.
Mui.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. So talking today with Stan Tatkin, who's a PsyD and MFT, clinician, researcher, teacher, and author of Love and War in Relationships and the CD's program, Your Brain on Love. When we come back, we're going to find out if you tend to be an island, a wave, or an anchor in your relationship and how this impacts your satisfaction and closeness and safety. You're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back. Thank you.
parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student. As a host for an exchange student, you'd have five main jobs to do. Those are the same five jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of The Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download The Exchange Student Model for Parenting today.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements before we get started again. Please tell your friends and family about Full Power Living, and you can subscribe to our series free on iTunes. You can also listen to our archives on emotionalpro.com whenever you're free to listen. I want to thank you, too, for helping us with our mission of sharing with the world the amazing transformative power of emotions. Next week, my guest is Mike Robbins, who appeared on Full Power Living to talk about his first book, Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken. He'll be talking about his latest book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, in which he explores self-compassion and gives ideas for getting out of our own way. That's Thursday, July 10th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. And the following week, I want to point out to you, we've been doing a series of question and answer programs with Sonia Rechna, co-founder of Accessing Universal Intelligence, so that you could call in and ask your most pressing questions. Well, on the 17th, we will have our final show with Sonia. So tell your friends and family and get there early. Make sure that you have an opportunity for Sonia to answer questions for you. That's coming up on the 17th. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Stan Tapkin, and we're talking about love and war in relationships. We're talking about how to set things up so that you can maintain a long-term relationship, offering safety and comfort to the people involved. So one of the things we wanted to talk about, Stan, was you say that there are three different kinds of people here, or three, you characterize them as waves and islands and anchors. As a way of giving us a picture of what we're trying to deal with, and I know this is quite involved and you could spend a lot of time on it, but could you briefly differentiate those three for us and why we might have trouble relating or what we need to know for relating?
Sure. An anchor from birth, here we're talking, an anchor is a child who consistently lived in a culture, felt that the relationship came first, that the parents were attentive and focused, curious, interested, and also well-resourced to be able to find this child over and over again, locate this child, this infant, this child, this adolescent, over and over again. But primarily the relationships come first in this culture over other issues around, surrounding the self. And people who are anchors tend to be a little more resilient, get along with more people. They're not as vulnerable to feeling or fears of being abandoned or being smothered or trapped. And so they have more flexibility. People who are more on the wave end of the spectrum are less secure in their relationships from early on. And they culture where it was important to take care of at least one of the parents, one of the caregivers' emotional state. And this is the codependent we were talking about earlier that engages in a one-way relationship where clinging and staying dependent and staying little was rewarded and even actually insisted upon. And so what happens is that with waves, they feel very angry and punished when anybody withdraws from them. This is because of repeated experience in childhood of a parent being overly preoccupied with him or herself and angry maybe themselves. And there sometimes and not there other times. So this inconsistency and this feeling of being loved and then suddenly the parent is unavailable feels like a ripoff and makes the child and the adult very angry. Because he or she is always anticipating being dropped, rejected, abandoned in some way, or punished. And so their attitudes often in relationship are, you know, very lively and very sweet, but also somewhat negativistic. The movement is to pull toward and push away. The island, on the other hand, tends to come from another direction of having to support at least one of the parents or one of the caregivers' sense of self-esteem. So self-esteem, performance, appearance, very important in the island culture. We don't ask for anything. We're not needy. We hate neediness. We don't depend on anybody. Nobody can do anything better than us. And so there's a distancing component. The island is afraid of being taken over, losing the herself, and so relationships then become a little bit dangerous. Their movement is to just go away. They leave. They withdraw. They like to be alone. I wrote a paper once called "Addicted to Alone Time," that I think describes the island. And "Allergic to Hope" is a title that I also wrote. I think gives you an idea of what the wave is dealing with. And so these two people, again, normal, this is just adaptation to a certain culture, but it's problematic in relationship because they're doing things that threaten one another, not even purposely, just automatically. And so they need to learn themselves and need to learn how to work the other person.
So then if one person is terrified of separation and the other one is self-soothing and likes to be an island, this can create terrible problems in a relationship.
Yeah, it can create terrible problems, but also can work out quite nicely if they understand the purpose of being together and that they have to know who they are and take responsibility for their reflexes. But also they have to know and accept their partner as is, and know how to manage them, how to work them, how to handle them. This goes back to, you know, to infants and caregivers. Caregivers have to know how to understand the child. They have to learn how to find the baby, and also how to there's a better word than manage, regulate, support, move, you know. But it's basically a sense of mastery that I know how you work and I know what to do.
Uh-huh. And now I was thinking about that when I was alone for 20 years and then remarried about 15 years ago with my husband, Bob. And he used to get upset with me if I would tell him that I had that I didn't like the way he was responding, say, to my something I was telling him. And it occurred to me that he was doing his best to relate to me, but he didn't know what I wanted.
Right.
So I would say to him, I want to tell you something, and I just want you to listen. I don't want you to say anything. And you do that. Or I would say to him, I want to tell you something, but I only want to hear your positive feedback, no negative. Can you do that? Or the third way would be, I would say, I want to tell you something and I'm open to your feedback. And that seemed to help so much. So that's the kind of reading and working with that you're talking about. And it took me realizing that I was looking for a certain thing and that he didn't have a knowledge of what it was I was looking for.
Yeah, we assume, I think that's all of us, we kind of assume things because we're, you know, we're operating on memory, and real time is extraordinarily fast. the chances of misunderstanding each other is so great that it's amazing that we ever get along at all. And then you get two people who become deep family, right, based on recognition. They found each other. Now their memory systems kind of blend and merge, and people are acting and reacting so quickly based on memory, not on thought and not on anything fancy, but basically just good old memory. I know what this is. I know what it means, and now I'm going to act on it. This is happening all the time. And this is one of the reasons that people get into trouble in their relationships. They're drawing automatically from their memory system, and they're reacting based on what their experience has been. And that's about as fancy as it gets. People are basically doing what they know, and what they know is what they've experienced, unless there's time and resources to think. But when we're under distress or stress, we don't have those resources, and we're more than not going to respond from this automatic place.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we do automatically is we make assumptions, either based on our previous relationships or some dream that we have,
right,
of what we can expect in a relationship. And I wrote down some of the things that you offered about, you know, for example, that all people are annoying and irritating, and that there's no such thing as a low maintenance person.
There isn't such thing as a low maintenance person up close, and even if they are right now, they won't be in another few years. So people are difficult, and we could say that there's nothing on the planet more difficult, really, than another person. You know, we need other people, and people are highly complex and problematic. And so here we have to learn how to deal with people and deal with our most precious people. But that anybody is under the misapprehension that people should be easy, that there is somebody out there that's actually terribly easy, is not really true. They may be easier than the person they had before. They may be easier at this moment. But eventually we all become very difficult. That's just the burden that is, you know, human relationships. And hopefully people are taking each other on as their burden, that's something that we're doing willingly. Otherwise, everyone's in for a big disappointment.
Now, one of the things that's helped me with that, Stan, is a spiritual, more spiritually oriented idea that we're all in a giant school and we've all come to this earth in order to grow, and therefore whatever I encounter in my relationships is something that's giving me an opportunity to grow. And when I can learn what's up there, I can resolve the issue with myself and with the other person. Do you have any comment on an approach like that?
No, it sounds nice. It sounds nice. I mean, that falls into the area of personal ideas of why suffer somebody who's frustrating at the moment. And that's, I think, one of many ideas that people should have in mind to remind themselves of why they're doing this. You know, why is this relationship there? There has to be something beyond personality and mood that holds people together. And I think that comes from an overarching understanding of the purpose of being with another person, and that two people hold to those ideas of mutuality. For instance, you know, thou shalt not kill is something that we all know. And yet, there is no such thing as thou shalt not kill if I'm not in the mood. It's not based on mood. It's not based on personality. It's an agreement that protects me and you. So do couples have these agreements that are based on life-supporting, life-enhancing principles beyond personality and mood? The majority of couples, I think, out there do not, and that becomes a problem. They can't answer the question of why, you know, why they're together, what's the purpose of them. And this is, I think, again, another overarching idea that keeps us in the saddle when we really want to jump out.
So this is interesting to me. This is not something that I thought of prior to the show. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking you're asking us to be both detail-oriented and to keep in mind a larger picture.
Actually, yes. That happens to be, now that you mentioned it, characteristic of the two sides of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could say the left hemisphere is much more involved in sequences, logic, and reason. The right hemisphere more involved in the gist of things and meaning. And it just so happens that waves tend to be very right brain, and islands tend to be very left brain. So here you have these two ways of looking at reality. And yes, we're talking about blending those two, that there's, mm-hmm. both are important, the bigger picture and also the detail.
So this reminds me, I've done a lot of reading with Deborah Tannen, who talks about male-female communication that John Gray drew from, for example.
Yes.
And her big point, and I think I'm getting it from you also over and over again, which is great, which is that there is no right or wrong. Just because a man can hear with half a brain and a woman can hear with both sides of the brain, that doesn't make one right and one wrong, one better or not better. So you're also saying, you know, being a wave is not better than being an island or worse than being an anchor or anything like that. You just are what you are.
You are what you are. And these types that we're talking about are really only important in terms of understanding where you come from and what your reflexes are given your history and memory. And then that gives you an idea of what you're going to do in the future with regard to moving toward a person, moving away from somebody. So it's helpful in that. It's also helpful, I think, that people are in a secure functioning relationship. That is, they're not necessarily secure themselves, but their relationship is an anchor-like relationship. They actually start to develop and become more anchor-ish. And not only that, their health improves. They look younger. They're reducing an enormous stress that is there all the time, simply because they provide assurances to each other that the relationship will exist, that the relationship can withstand who they are. In other words, they take off the table one of the major insecurities that plague us, that will bring us to an early grave, and that is they are tethered to each other. And that is no small thing. That's no small thing. So we're also talking about health and stress systems and the wear and tear on the body, that to be in a secure functioning relationship is to reduce that load, which is something else that we want to do.
I was just watching a PBS program about Siberian tigers last night, and there were poachers there, and they weren't doing well in terms of their health, much less the poachers, because they didn't have a safe place to live.
Right.
And that's what you're talking about, that we need to create our relationship as a safe place for us and our partner to live.
Two people can do that if they agree to do it. Otherwise, they're basically exposed to the environment, which is, you know, not especially caring. So, yeah, we're talking again about two people doing these things for each other because they can and because the alternative is actually not great. So this is an understanding. This is why I say that I've seen street people form secure functioning relationships. They understand that that together they can protect each other. Apart, they are overly vulnerable to the environment, and that's secure functioning.
There seems to be a little danger in that. Let me just devil's advocate here for a minute.
Sure.
I had a sister who was 22 months older than me in the childhood situation that I was in, and she and I made that kind of connection. We helped each other, even though we also had our wars. And we had to make a shift in our 30s because we were so focused on protecting. You know, it's like we had our backs back to back, and the whole world was hostile to us. Can't that happen also in long-term intimate relationships like a marriage?
Well, a marriage that shuts itself off to people, that isolate and shut themselves off from the outside world, usually that speaks to a trauma, unresolved trauma in the system. But that couple we can think of as a folly ado. That is, you know, two people, because of their isolation, social isolation, they can actually spin down into madness, just like a person who is living alone and never seeing anybody, talking to anybody, can also do the same. So that would be a situation, you know, where two people, you know, shut themselves off from the outside world. That's not good, but it's still, they're still insulated, they're still protecting each other, and so that's not too bad. But obviously the outcome is not great, because secure functioning couples are inclusive, they're not exclusive. By that I mean they have resources to spare to include family, community, and others. They don't have to be in hiding, and that speaks more to trauma, I think.
That's a really good point, which certainly was, well, of course, we were young, so.
You had to do that.
Yeah. So then in a marriage, a long-term functioning marriage, you, when you're focused on growing, when you're focused on creating the love and acceptance for each other that you want, it seems like it would tend to also want lead you to connect with the outside world, because the outside world, all the interactions we have, help us to do our growing.
Yes. When we're tethered to another person securely, we tend to be nicer people. We have more energy. We're more courageous. We're more social. We're more inventive. We are better. And that's because there's a secure base that we can run to, that we have. And that secure base, of course, in adulthood should be fully mutual, not one directional.
That's really, I love that. So now I listened to your CD album, Your Brain on Love, and what are the best ways, let me, before I forget here, ask you, what are the best ways for people to get your CD set, Your Brain on Love, or your book, Love and War and Relationships?
Well, there, Love and War and Wired for Love, which is another book, actually more suited for the public, Wired for Love, people can get that any bookstore, Amazon, any place where books are sold. Your Brain on Love, which is a 6-CD set from Sounds True, they can download it as an MP3 from SoundsTrue.com or Audible.com, or they can just order the 6-CD set from anybody, from Amazon and so on. I believe we even have it on our site as well. For clinicians who want credit, CEU credit, they can download, get the credit also.
And your site is StanTatkin.com.
StanTatkin.com, yes.
StanTatkin.
Right. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. I sometimes can't understand, so I try to spell here. I am a therapist, but I love Your Brain on Love. You just go from one wonderful thing to the next, and
thank you.
I played part of it for my husband. I fit the wave and he fits the island. And he took what I played for him to heart and started acknowledging verbally my efforts and the things I was doing. And I noticed that in one day it made a huge difference to me. I felt so much more nurtured and appreciated and seen. And so I really think, yeah, this way was really helpful. So thanks. I learned a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Eileen. Thank you very much. That's very kind.
Yeah. So how does stabilizing yourself as a couple, when you use this approach, what benefit does it give to children in a relationship?
If people see themselves, and this is, you know, opposite sex and same sex couples, all couples, if people see themselves as the roof of the house, the executive function, the executors, the king and queen of the house, of the land, then their care of each other and the resources they create and free up for one another benefits everyone below them and around them. So children are always going to benefit from seeing their parents take good care of each other. Kids want to see their parents happy so that they can go on being a kid and all is good in the land. And they don't have to worry about their parents. So being good managers of each other, being in each other's care, being in a couple bubble is going to help everybody around. The couple becomes more available and actually more attractive to the outside world as well. The world has always been attracted more to couples than to individuals. And it's just the way, again, I think we're wired. We love couples, always have. We trust a couple more than we trust an individual if they're approaching. And but especially couples that are doing it right and doing it well, very attractive. So I think everybody benefits and the kids mostly.
Now, I want to go back. Early in the show, you said that at what time you were focused on working with people with character disorders. What
yes.
if one person, character disorder, the way I understand it, is basically somebody who's pretty intractable in who they are. They have a pattern for operating that's very difficult to change, and it can be very frustrating to live with someone with
yes.
a character disorder. Can your way of thinking be applied in a marriage where one person has a character disorder?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's really not a problem. PACT was built from the ground up to deal with the most difficult couples. And because of my background in trauma and in character disorders, this was part of the building blocks of PACT. So, yes, it's not, you know, it's no picnic to have a character disorder. And so, you know, there are people out there with, you know, all kinds of mental illness, including brain injury. And they also can form, and they do, I've seen it, form secure functioning relationships. They do. I've had people with, you know, two partners with Asperger's, and they do beautifully. So it's a departure from our idea about relationship, especially pair bonding, having to do with the individual idea of being mentally well or being this or that. Fortunately for us as a human species, we don't need to be any particular way except willing to be in a system or to be part of a system that is fair, that is just, and that's sensitive to one another. That comes from an idea that's just smart in terms of survival. Anybody can get that, and when they do, they can be in a secure functioning relationship.
Great. So if I didn't want to make this a do-it-yourself project, I know through PACT you're training therapists. How would our listeners go about finding someone trained in your methods to work with?
There, I think we have a new site called thepactinstitute.com, I think, and I should know this, but I don't. People can find that link, I'm sure, on stantacken.com. And there we're beginning to build a list of people who are trained. We're just now building our core faculty in the United States. As we continue to grow as an institute and teach therapists, I think there'll be more and more people available.
Okay. So in the meantime, until that gets done, from all that you've learned, if you put yourself in the place of someone listening to today's show, what is the most important thing for them to remember in order to nurture their long-term relationship and have it work well for both people?
Being able to accept your partner as is and then pay attention and know your partner well. I think that idea, are you good at your job, are you good at him or her, is a good starting point in terms of attitude. Because a lot of this is attitudinal and has to do with the spirit of something. And so you know, I think for most people, they probably picked right, but the person they picked, they may not exactly know how to handle, and they may not know how to be in the relationship. So I think first and foremost is, you know, accepting yourself, accepting your partner, and going from there, and being very curious. There's too many other things to say, but that would be an important one. And also, I think to think of each other as in the foxhole together, if you have that image, and that you, you know, that you are fidelitous to that relationship, that you protect each other in public and private, yeah, that you tell each other everything because you can, you know, that you treat each other as two people who need each other. And in the right ways. So there's a lot to say about that, but I think in a nutshell. There you go.
That's terrible, terrible. Actually, I dated a man at one point who was a painter, and he had a painting that he did. It was a man and a woman each hanging from a yardarm, and they were fighting. And the name of it was Till Death Do Part. Right. So that's the kind of thing we don't want to do in our foxhole, the idea of thinking in the foxhole. You don't have much room to move around, and if it's dangerous in there, you're going to be killed either by somebody outside or somebody inside, or you'll be messed up by something at any rate.
Yeah, I think if people think about it, they'll see that, you know, there are cultures, there are places on the planet where people do not have time to think about whether they're with their soulmate. They're too busy dodging bombs, and they, you know, they stick together because the environment requires it. Again, like I said, we live in a culture that doesn't require this. We don't have anything built into our social structure that says you guys pair bond to protect each other, to provide a safe place for each other beyond these other ideas. I just want to give a shout out very quickly to Relationships First Council. That is what Tracy and I are involved with Harville and Helen and people like John Gottman and Sue Johnson and Marion Solomon. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are on this board. We're committed to a 50-year mission to change the culture here and to start to give some sense of importance to relationship as not just a social and political issue, but also a health issue as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds wonderful. What a wonderful group of people.
Yeah, well, it's a good group.
Yes. What you've brought together in understanding and working with couples is down to earth. It's phenomenal, groundbreaking, and I just really want to thank you for bringing all your years of work together and bringing it, sharing it with the rest of us and dedicating yourself to such things as a 50-year mission for relationships, working with relationships. So thank you, Stan, for being with us and also for being who you are. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Irene. Thank you so much for your generosity.
All right. So remember that Stan Tatkin's book is called Love and War in Relationships. He also has one, Wired for Love. And his CD program is Your Brain on Love. His website is stantatkin.com. Next week, join me for my conversation with former baseball player Mike Robbins, who's author of Nothing Changes Until You Do. That's Thursday, July 10th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time or noon Eastern. And don't forget that Accessing Universal Intelligence co-founder Sonia Recknitzer will be doing her last Q&A session the following week, July 17th. Now, we will continue these sessions to have Sonia. We're going to have myself and other mentors who've been trained by Sonia who will continue to offer this demonstration. So look for the announcement of that. But be sure to mark your calendar for the 17th also and call in early so you can get your questions answered by one of the best. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer. Thank you very much, Paul. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you of how much I appreciate that you've been here today and that you'll be here with us in the future. And also reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.